Hey everyone, welcome back to part two of Articulate Warblings, A Year in Our Life. So, part two. And more of Zach and Laura talking about what Zach and Laura like to talk about. Media, and what they're watching and what they're reading. And here's part two. And remember to rate, review, subscribe to Articulate Warbling. And if you listen to it on my RSS feed, write, review, and subscribe to that one, too. But thank you again so much. And we look forward to another year with you. And if you want to help the show grow, tell your friends about it. And, yeah, rate, review, subscribe, like I said a few moments ago. You can follow Zach at SweatDrenchedRit on Instagram. And also, if you go to Facebook, you can find Articulate Warbling there. And you can, do whatevs. All right, here we go. Part two.
Welcome back to part two of A Year in Our Lives.
Plus usual miscellaneous warbling stuff. We have changed out of our... Your boobs, all right?
Yeah, it's a bit nippy.
Stop it!
Anyway, we have changed out of our dress wear to our nightwear, which will probably be stripped off in about 45 minutes.
Very presumptuous of you.
That was presumptuous of you, inferring, so I've continued in the theme. Anyway, we're going on to review, what am I reviewing? Akira.
Yeah.
Akira, meant to be one of the most highly regarded animes. It was released on Blu-ray not that long ago, and I remember that it hit the big screens. I don't know if it was a 4K restoration. Now, this was not a 4K restoration. It actually looked like a DVD was projected at Cineworld. I can't tell if it's Cineworld's issue or it was just... Anyway, what do I have to say about Akira? It's overrated. It's boring. There's not much going for it. And I know it's... Oh, you can't love anime if you don't like Akira. No, I don't like Akira. All these years, it's being held up as something. And this potential of it being a live-action movie by Taika Waititi. You know what Taika Waititi will give it? An actual presence, an actual character. Anime has always been very sporadic, very up and down, tonally uneven. That's why people love it. It can be comedy, melodrama, love story, cyberpunk, violent, gory, with real weird senses of irrelevant humour. It was shite!
Didn't you walk out?
I walked out at least 20 minutes before the end, because first of all, no one was social distancing. Everyone there was a sweaty, obese person. Who, I mean, one person in there was breathing for the whole lot of us. I lost nachos! He was really chowing down in three nachos, the popcorn, and then not only that, he brought another bag of popcorn.
Can I just point out, this day that Zach went to go and see Akira is the day I went to see After We Collided with my mum. And Zach's film was going to finish about 45 minutes, even moving on to an hour after mine. So I'd specifically gone and got the car, paid for the parking, dropped my mum home. I get a message from Zach the second I get home, which is literally 10 minutes after we left, with, can you come pick me up, please? I'm outside Santander.
Yeah, please, can you pick me up? It was unbearable. It was boring. It was plaintive. I think the only thing that I really liked was some of the score. It's this deep, guttural throat music, throat breathing, rasping breath. Some action sequences were good, but I think it is very underwhelming. There's so much better out there narratively and much better things to personify anime. This was just awful. For years, people kept telling me, you have to watch it. It's this big peak, this pinnacle of anime. To be honest, for me, it was the most boringest piece of shit I've ever watched.
So we had a conversation, didn't we? And I said, maybe I want to go and see it with you because I like going to the cinema with you. And the more you talk about it, the more I'm like, thank God I dodged
it
that bullet.
It was painful. And I thought, Akira.
No, Laura.
Akira's up here for so many people. It's an opportunity. You have to watch it on the big screen if you can. Mm. So I thought, okay, I'm not going to pass up that opportunity. And I couldn't have thought of anything worse to watch. I mean, it was awful. The animation isn't even up there. The storyline is non-existence. The flights of pseudo-religioso spirituality just corrupted everything else. It is just a mess. And William S. Burroughs, you are freaking me the fuck out. You are staring into my soul. You weren't an anime fan, because I don't even think anime was around when you were alive.
How are you going to sleep tonight?
I mean, if my dick starts shriveling up inside me...
that usually happens anyway.
When we make love, this will reassure you. William S. Burroughs staring at my splayed ass, you know, this will reassure you that.
You're definitely not homosexual.
And not wanting William S. Burroughs' pencil dick up my ass.
So anyway, how many stars would you give Akira?
None.
Really? That bad?
It's a turkey.
What about the score, though? Does that not, like, edge up to...
No, because it was about 20 seconds of...
I probably could have done better sound effects from copyright-free YouTube picks.
I mean, as an experimental artist, a lot of people go, who the fuck do you think you are saying this? You made a fucking 20-minute video about coffee, and it's like, yes, but I went into this anticipating to have my mind blown, like saying, oh, it was heavily the Matrix was heavily influenced by the likes of this. I don't think it was. Anyway, if anyone is inspired by Akira, God help you, because I ain't watching your film. No, there has been loads of films inspired by it. Design-wise, with some of the gadgets and all that, yeah, I can see the appeal. But it just didn't work for me.
Okay, so moving on to a not even much in the way of better review, Cloud Atlas.
Yeah, well, I've had a long history of Cloud Atlas. Saw it at the cinemas. Had a really bad toothache. I was suffering. Suffer a lot of my teeth. Touch wood, been alright so far. Something's going to happen now. Anyway, went out for a fag, came back in, said to my mate Max, anything happened? And he was like, no. And I was like, sexy? And he was like, no. He lied to me. And I think he lied because he got a boner over those plastic breasts. Anyway, long story short, Cloud Atlas, rewatched it on Blu-ray, and then I was totally taken away by it. I was like, oh my god, this is ingenious. So much, it's ingenious. And showed the trailer to Laura, and Laura was like, yeah, it looks pretty good. I would happily watch this. And within the first 30 minutes, I think both me and Laura sunk into ourselves.
I was pretty ready for bed, and it was 7:30.
Yeah.
No, wait, it was earlier than that. It was 6:30.
Yeah.
We started at 6:00. So yeah. By 6:45, I'm like, I'd rather go to bed than watch this drivel.
Yeah. It's I wouldn't even claim it's pretentious. It is just so boring.
I think the thing is there's too many age eras.
Yeah.
To follow.
Mm.
Because I get there was a point that I should have tried to follow, but I couldn't follow it.
No, because it was too much was going on.
Yeah.
And a reviewer from Empire said something that, oh, due to its near 3-hour length, it doesn't drag. Oh boy, does it drag.
It's dragged so much. Like, I felt every second of those 3 hours
felt
12.
And it felt like we were actually going through the motions of what the characters were.
That was really boring.
Being reincarnated through millennia.
Yeah.
It was boring. It may be visually appetizing. Some other stories are elevated over the rest, but then they just don't play out to any worthwhile conclusion. I think it was very messy. I know that it was ambiguous and ambitious, but I've had this complaint with Redcon 1. And being ambitious does not make a film any good. You can be ambitious and, you know, it's like, whoa, that guy took an ambitious shit. It still is shit and it smells and you don't want it on your carpet.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Much more beautiful than the film.
Yes, it was, actually. Cloud Atlas is a...
pointless waste of 3 hours?
Yeah, and a waste of $178 million.
Jesus, yeah.
And it made none of it back.
And also, can I just say, the bit where they were like, what was it, like 240 years after the fall or whatever they called it?
No, no, tall, tall, no, no, lip, lip, and helly belly, tinny, 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 whip, whip.
That's the only time I truly felt that... What's his name?
Tom Hanks.
Thank you. It's the only time I truly felt that Tom Hanks was a bit of a shit actor.
Mm. A lot of people thought it was when he played that Cockney gangster. I thought it was fucking hilarious.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah. I like the whole Jim Broadbent thing, but because... Yeah, so,
but I like Jim Broadbent. I don't know, there's something about it.
But the thing is, that story... certain stories are elevated over the others, but then that one gets so submerged in the sci-fi one about the fabricant,
yeah.
Who's... so much is... It kind
but
of
they don't give you enough context.
It numbs. Well, it's all about reincarnation at the end of it, and yeah, about different paths. And
I do get that, but it doesn't give you enough context behind each storyline to understand
it. Not at all.
It.
All apart from having Halle Berry at one point play an old Asian man, have Halle Berry play a German woman, have an Asian woman play a cave woman. It's I know what they were going for. It's like it's non-biased. It's like we can be reincarnated in any form or body. I get that. I liked what it had to say about... I love personally also the love story and the whole thing about the Cloud Atlas sextet. I thought that would have worked. I think what they needed to strike...
They could have made a 3-hour film about that
I mean, what they should have struck from it, and I know it's the most visual, broadest sci-fi thing. I think the whole story about that fabricant could have been cut.
Yeah,
they
needed
to destroy, not even contemplate that fucking ridiculous story about the lawyer on the ship getting slowly poisoned. That was not necessary.
No.
Not at all. I know what they were trying to say about slavery, but it's contextualisation of it didn't work.
It wasn't enough. It wasn't like I feel bad for anyone. I was just confused. I just didn't get it.
I mean, you could have isolated those certain ones and it would have worked on their own as its own movie.
Yeah.
The thing was, someone said the book is very similar to short film. This is this person's story. And then it's for you to pick up on the themes and the connotations out of your
own. I could do that.
Out of your own time. Spot the thing.
You can't make a film out
of
that.
What they've done is they've done this film that is non-linear. They've cut it up and they've mixed it up because they thought that the cinematic language of that would be more pivotal. It'd be more of a puzzle piece. The thing is, this isn't a puzzle piece that comes to any known formation or conclusion. It's you've worsened it. And I know the they went off on their own ends and they directed their own segments and they intercut it and interweaved it and tried to give some symmetry to it. There's no symmetry. It's
no,
just messy.
It is.
If you went by have two stories side by side, have them come to a conclusion, then transcend into maybe one more and then trickle out to another one. Okay, it could work. Maybe.
But there were like six.
Intercut.
Yeah.
And it is very hard to follow.
And the only context they gave you was at the very, very beginning of all the different years. And I started to get confused. And then because I couldn't identify whether that person was supposed to be this person, I couldn't quite understand.
And the great confusion is, with having all these actors playing different roles, one moment... Like, I think Hugh Grant gets such short shrift. He is wasted in this fucking film.
Is.
I mean, this
he did it for like a total of 5 minutes.
I mean, the whole point of his casting in it, I know it was a brave move because this was a time where he kind of trickled out and no one was interested in him.
Mm.
And he returned to cinema as a bit role in this where he played a cannibal, he played an American businesswoman, he played an Asian...
Did he play an American businesswoman?
He could have.
You've got women on your mind.
I mean, like, he played an American businessman. He played a Asian... restaurant owner who liked to fuck his fabricants and...
Oh, was that
drink
him?
Soap, yeah.
Oh.
There was no consistency. One minute you're telling me that there's this... almost PTSD suffering.
He did like
man.
A consequence thing.
Well, this is the thing. Why is there that Tom Hanks was a villainous Irish doctor, transcends and becomes a villainous unread writer who then becomes successful because he throws a critic off a roof? Why does he then transcend and become later in 70s, back from 2012, an honourable man at that company? It had no continuity of reasoning. If it showed
at one point he literally worked at a hotel.
Yeah, it makes no sense as to this whole thematic of having past lives. Why is he this person in this time frame?
there needed to be like a consequence. Like, you know how
you've lived awfully in the past,
so you're going to suffer for it in the next one.
There was no indication of that. There's
that well-known phrase, I must have done something bad in a past life.
That's not applied here.
No, that's what I mean. There was no consequence for me. It's just like, if you've lived a really bad life in a past life, then the whole point is that you're supposed to be a good guy next time, but you get shit on.
Yeah.
For me, that would have made a good film, but it didn't take that
No
turn.
Rhyme or reason.
No.
No continuity behind it. I think that this whole people in a past life, do you think that they have ripples out in time? And it's like, yes, that is a cool fucking concept that sells me. Yeah, but
they didn't mention it until 2 hours and 21 minutes. And then
it doesn't suffice to say do anything because these other ones don't have any tie to one moment. One moment this person who's meant to be a revolutionary, this fabricant, has this comet thing next to a PTSD suffering post-fall caveman going, you know, true, who keeps seeing this fucking Irish devil. To be honest, that crux of reincarnation, yeah, it's a cool concept. Yeah, it allows us, our actors, to show their range. Yes! Show your range! Use that!
In a good film!
But take advantage of what you have. And apparently the book is so much better because it is read cinematic language translated, that short films piled together. But in Hollywood, the people won't go to see a film that's built of short films. Well, people don't go to fucking see a film that's cut as shittily as this, which they obviously didn't. And I know that the philosophy and the allegory and the Wachowski siblings at the time, yeah, they started being known as the Wachowskis because Larry had transitioned into Lana. I know that they sometimes hit a certain peak of, I wouldn't even say it's pretension, because pretension is in the eye of the beholder, but they hit a certain peak of where their concepts, their hypotheticals, metaphoricals, their philosophical bearings hits a certain stride that they are about 10,000 leagues ahead of you, whilst actually not fuss realising they're actually 10,000 steps behind the audience, because we're sitting there already prefabricating how this film could be better way before it's even concluded.
Mm.
Cloud Atlas, 1 star.
I'm going to go for none.
Whoa! Your Akira is Cloud Atlas.
Yeah. There was nothing in it that took me at all. And I can't rate a film 1 star because it had Hugh Grant and Tom Hanks in it. That's not enough for me.
I understand that. Like the whole thing with Akira, just, yeah, the score, I liked it, but it wouldn't elevate it. The whole reason that I gave it 1 star is I did emote from certain moments.
Yeah, I can appreciate that, but that, again, like you said, with Akira and the score, it's not enough.
Yeah.
It doesn't. I understand that.
I mean, I could easily say it's a 0.5-star thing. Yeah. I appreciate for what it's going for. I don't really like
0.5-stars. I did at first. I was like, can I give it 3.5? But no, I don't really like that half thing now. It just feels like it's like a cop-out. So, yeah, as far as I'm concerned, 0 stars.
So Cloud Atlas is not on our recommended
Absolutely lists. Not.
So,
go and do something better in 3 hours of your life.
I mean, watch V for Vendetta.
Ugh.
Watch Speed Racer. Watch the Matrix trilogy.
Never seen it.
Watch
Twilight.
No, you know what? Take advantage of those 3 hours and write something better.
Good thinking.
Batman.
So we're going to go into book reviews. My stomach is gurgling like you would not believe. It's so much food. It's just like, please help me.
Well, if people do not know, we are on a fasted diet. And this is the first time me and Laura have engorged ourselves on any form of prolonged food. If that makes sense.
Look, we don't have breakfast, we have a milkshake. We don't have lunch, we have a milkshake. We have a few snacks in between, which mostly consists of fruit or crackers. And a little bit of cheese every now and then.
Well, that was just today. It was a special day.
And then we just have our usual dinner.
What did you say? You throw caution to the wind on this day, didn't you? Or say we...
I said basically there's no point because we're both going to have a starter, a main and a pudding. So we might not... There's no point in bothering, really.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I still have my shake this morning because I don't have anything for breakfast. I had crackers for lunch and cheese.
And Laura popped a Wensleydale cherry.
I did. Wensleydale's very yummy. So now my stomach is literally going, what have you done to me? Because I've filled it up with like full fat cream and other richness that my stomach's a bit confused about. Anyway, we're going to go on to put some book reviews. So I'm just going to thrash mine out and then let you rant away.
So I mean, I have very little to say about it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna start anyway because, well, ladies first. I'm going to start off with This Is Going to Hurt by Adam Kay. Now, Zach is probably going to look at me with some weird eyes in a minute because I feel like the longer I haven't been reading it for, the better it got.
Huh?
The more I think about it and that I'm not actually in it anymore, the better it is.
No, it's just because the woman who lent you the book you were faced with today and you had to make out that you enjoyed it.
That wasn't today, that was yesterday.
I don't know what day it is.
Wednesday, the 14th of October, 2020.
I ain't getting out my car, day.
Yeah, I ain't getting out my fucking car, it's raining. I mean, look, the problem I had is I read The Secret GP relatively recently, and it...
Relatively fucking quickly as well.
I did read that very quickly.
And you had such a great positive reaction from it.
I did.
And I might have to read it next.
I think the problem is the fact that because I read that, it meant that I couldn't really appreciate This Is Going to Hurt, purely because it felt like it was a bit samey.
Yeah.
The difference is that a GP I can relate to a bit more, because I've seen my GP far more than I've ever seen a junior doctor in a hospital.
Yeah.
However, I did laugh quite a bit. This Is Gonna Hurt.
A few times, yeah.
I did laugh, and I did think that there were some funny bits. One, I won't give it away because I think you should read it at some point.
Oh, please no.
I think you might enjoy it. One where there is a man involved with a lamppost, and another where a woman attempts to count the number of weeks in her life when she's asked how many weeks are you, relating to her pregnancy, but says I'm 32 but I can't figure it out, which is pretty hilarious, to be honest. But yeah, there's just, I mean, it's interesting, what can I say? It is interesting. There were some funny bits, and I liked the honesty of the ending and how he is no longer a junior doctor.
Oh, okay.
Why he's no longer a doctor.
Okay.
Which I thought was really, really interesting and really kind of helpful to see why people do leave and how he feels bad because he's wasted the government's money in training him for 10 years.
And he's given it up.
And he's given it up because he can't hack it. Mm. So actually, I think in that sense it was good.
You said originally it was 2-star read.
I did. I did say that. I think it's going to up to a 3-star. So it's still not a hugely wow-wee book. But I think if it's the first ever kind of honest review of somebody in the life of something, yeah, a profession, I think you'd probably really enjoy it.
Yeah.
But I think because I'd seen the... Because I'd read The Secret GP... Not The Secret GP. Is it The Secret GP? Yes, it is The Secret GP.
Secret GP.
Because I'd read that, it becomes a bit samey. And Zach's just bought me a book about... nurses in a similar context, but as I said to him this morning, I'm just going to leave it a couple of months before
I think that's the best thing to do.
Take that off of the radar for now, because otherwise I'm not going to enjoy it, and perhaps I probably would have done. I felt rushed into reading This Is Going to Hurt because a colleague had lent it to me.
Yeah.
So it's more like
obligatory. You have to
The next time I see her,
there's nothing worse than someone saying, "Here's a book to read." A year later, it's like, "I have my book back."
Yeah, exactly. And I'm seeing her on the 2nd of November, and I plan to give her the book she lent me, and then give her a book to borrow.
Yeah.
So it's kind of that thing of like, I felt a bit like rushed into. See, it's into reading it.
Don't do it. Don't give anyone your fucking books. But you have a plan, man.
Zach doesn't like to share books. And I'm not so bothered.
So.
3 stars for This Is Going to Hurt by Adam Kay. I would recommend reading it, especially if you haven't read anything like it before.
Okay.
The Guest List by Lucy Foley. Well, what can I say? There appears to be an aeroplane outside.
No, that's a motorcycle.
Vroom, vroom. It's an aeroplane.
That just ended.
You can still hear it. It's an aeroplane.
That's a motorbike.
It's an aeroplane.
There's always a motorbike at this time doing that noise.
It's an aeroplane.
It's a motorbike plane.
It's a plane bike.
It's a plane bike. Anyway.
It's an aerobike.
Aerobike. Mm.
Anyway. The Guest List by
Patent Lucy. Patent it. What?
The Guest List. Something that threw me at the beginning, because it usually with a thriller like this, with a murder mystery type, you know somebody's murdered and then you spend the next 365 pages finding out how, who, why, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
The difference is with this book is you know somebody's going to be murdered because it's all over the blurb. It's all over the book.
Mm.
You know, there's an invite to this island and death comes with it. Who's going to survive? Blah, blah, blah. You know that somebody's died. You know there's been a murder, but it doesn't actually tell you. It just alludes to it.
I hate books like that. I've picked up so many books where it says, blah, 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 something happens and you're reading the book and you're going, when is it going to happen? When is it going to happen? And I got to a book recently and it got to page 200. I'm like, oh no, are we actually going to get into the meat and vegetables of the actual fucking story 200 pages in?
That's how we were with the guest list. Yeah. And I really struggled with that. However, I love, love, love a book that has chapters that are specific to different characters.
It offers a lot, doesn't it?
A lot. So you had an overall view of what was going on right now, which was the murder, current murder scene. Then you had the bride.
Yeah.
The bridesmaid.
Mm.
The groom.
Yeah.
And the plus one, they called her.
Okay.
So the husband, the wife of one of the ushers.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean, when I got to the end, I went, whoa.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
And all of the stories interconnected, and I was not expecting
that. So that lasts, what was it, 150 pages?
I'd say probably around 70.
Where it eventually picks up, its feet comes together. Is it warranted? Do you feel it needed more, or was that enough?
No. That was enough.
Okay. Because is it so rip-roaring?
Yeah, you learn everything all the way through. Oh, and there was the character, which is the planner, the wedding planner.
Wedding planner.
And other than the fact that one of the names is Irish, which I had to Google, because I can't read a book without knowing how to pronounce certain words or
You haven't followed in things. The Zac Ferguson...
I couldn't, though, because it was such a weird spelling. So it's the Irish spelling of a name, which is Efi, and it's spelled A-I-O-F-E.
Oh, yeah, we had a conversation like that. There's Owen Cofer, and it's spelled Ian.
There was actually an Ian.
Was there?
Not an Ian, an Owen.
Owen.
But when I looked at it, I went, that's Owen. Yeah. And that was quite obvious for me. But maybe that's because we'd had that conversation.
No, I'm just relatively stupid.
No, but I think we'd had the conversation about how you spell Owen in Irish. Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's Owen. That makes sense.
And I mean, the poor guy for years has had to put in his fucking biography, it's pronounced Owen. Like, hello, Mr. Ian Cofer. He's like, it's Owen, mate, come on. I'm not that Irish.
But yeah, I mean, it didn't need anything else.
No.
It was pretty up there. To be honest, it knocked a star off because I felt like it was just a bit...
The blurb gave away too fucking much.
Yeah, and also the fact that it just needed to have come a little quicker to that crescendo for me. You know, it's a 300-page book.
Yeah.
And to be in the last 70 pages and finally find out what's going on and then for it to end was all a bit like...
So it was basically you were stuck in traffic, stop starting, and then when the accident is cleared, you were full pelt down the motorway, 80 miles per hour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing that knocked a star off for me, because I just felt like it could have been brought in a little earlier. Mm. And I was waiting for the next what's happening right now in the moment. But yeah, I don't think it needed any more.
No.
So yeah, it was a 4-star book. It is a 4-star book.
Nice. Now.
So that leaves you with The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat.
And I also want to read out a few reviews that I've read recently, and I completely forgot that I'd written reviews, and I like usually to go off from... written bits and just build off of it. But The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, Oliver Sacks is this much lauded professor, neuropsychologist, psychiatrist, all these things, and I read The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. I know a lot of other works had come before it, but what this book does is offers very vague insights as to Oliver Sacks' own personal perspective. Now, I shared on Facebook that I was currently reading it. I didn't give away my opinion. I didn't really give away how I was feeling. And the first 70 pages going into it, I was relatively into it. Now, the issue is, Oliver Sacks has not given much insight behind it. Also, considering the day and age it was written, there was a bone for me to pick, a contention. A lot of the more denser hypotheticals and psychiatric evaluations and perspectives are offered by people who aren't Oliver Sacks, but it is transcribed and quoted from other people in his professions. Oliver Sacks recounts the stories of patients lost in the bizarre, apparently inescapable world of neurological disorders. Now, there's a very, there's a teetering edge to this where it's very obvious Oliver Sacks is in that mandated, very structured, this is the way things work, and the usage of the word retards, and there's a certain bit in it when it spoke about autism and this, this conception within the, in the verse of neuropsychology and neurological disorders, that autistic people are incapable of being artistic. And Oliver Sacks was very dead cert on the stance that this was true, and that it does later, because I had an adverse reaction, like, I fucking hate this, how fucking dare he, a man in his position, la-di-da-di-da, for a neurologist of all people. Then it came to the conclusion that he didn't believe that, but he kind of saw the light, but it just kind of rubbed me up the wrong way. Also, there's not much insight, there's insight to people's different quirks and habits and tics and Tourette's. Some of the stories are quirky, but conceptually they're funny, but the actual stories aren't that compelling. They're rather mote and similar, and I felt it was boring. I was bored, and it just was a slog. I hope, because I've been stupid enough and brought the majority of his catalogue, because Will Self highly regards him, as do many other people when it comes to neuropsychology. Maybe this is one of the damp squibs in his catalogue of works. I've seen a movie based upon his book, Awakenings, with Robin Williams and Robert De Niro, and that knowledge and knowing the type of things he's talking upon, psychiatry, neurological conditions, talking about the mysteries of consciousness, and just Oliver Sacks is renowned for his brilliant insights, and I felt he didn't bring much to the table when it comes to the man who mistook his wife for a hat. It was very disappointing, so I gave it, and will keep it, at a 2-star read. I brought the majority of them on the cheap from HMV, but I am still very interested in Oliver Sacks as the man, and not just his perspectives in his profession, being a neurologist. But anyway, a review for a children's book, the latest release by Neil Gaiman, illustrated by Chris Riddell. And anyone who knows me personally, Chris Riddell, I'm a huge fanboy of, and especially when partnered up with Paul Stewart. They are the reason I am a writer. They are the reason I read. They are the reason that I, as a person at the time who really wasn't accepting of his, you know, neurological condition, their worlds and their scapes and visions, the Edge Chronicles, the far-flung adventures, Barnaby Grimes, the illustrations of Chris Riddell offered me a world that I was like, this stuff exists, and also I can explore this, not just in visual illustrations and visual pictures, but through words. It was through Paul Stewart and Chris Riddell. How people acknowledge writers like Tolkien and G.K. Chesterton or P.G. Wodehouse or people with real rapport. I look upon Paul Stewart and Chris Riddell as the people who really crafted me alongside George Lucas and really built me at that impressionable age as you're growing up and what you soak up. They introduced me to fantasy, genre, world building, and the power of expression through artistic means. So I've read Pirate Stew. I basically brought it on a whim. Getting something signed by Neil Gaiman is very expensive. Very, very expensive. Like, when it's attributed to his Sandman comic collections, even to his other much earlier works. But this was a new exclusive Waterstones book. So I basically brought it because, A, I love Chris Riddell. B, I am a fan. Not so much anymore of Neil Gaiman. I appreciate him and love him for what he does. But I got it because it was basically a signed book by Neil Gaiman. Why would I pass up that chance? So I pre-ordered it, and I read it relatively quick, in 10 minutes. Finished this, I did, in 3, maybe a bit quicker than thee, but can only think one will pore over it for 13 or so more. Well, that is in minutes. Sorry, that was my little ditty-do summing it up for you. Okay, I'll stop now. Sorry. I'm just
saying sorry to me.
Well, I'm saying sorry because I'm rhyming. Anyway, when it comes to heartiness and bold, vibrant, eye-catching colours and larger-than-life, beautifully realised art and the line work that is so inherently Chris Riddell, it is done by Chris Riddell in partnership with Neil. Now, it's something one will trace their fingers over, be taken over by the vibrancy, the wonder, and the unashamedly whimsicality of it all. And you just smile, even if Chris Riddell is dealing with the more dark or topical, because he is a satirist and a political cartoonist. There's something so wholly unique about Chris Riddell's art, and it is his line work. As that is the effect and affect of Riddell's art, and Gaiman's almost exalted love for the visual medium contained in literature. And I purchased this as both a Riddell fan, as illustrator and writer, and he's someone I always gravitate towards, especially when he's partnered up with Paul Stewart, and even on his own. Like, I remember when he started releasing books, the Otterline book series, and I was just like, oh my god, Chris Riddell's writing on his own, to really see where Chris Riddell stands out as a literary type himself. But he now works more frequently with Neil Gaiman. And I'll invest and ingest it for all that it is. And the same goes for anything Neil writes. Neil Gaiman is still a very personable and attractive writer. The stuff that he writes and does, I think he believes a bit too much in his own celebrity now, and I think he's kind of lost sight of that. But together they're a perfect pairing, and I'm glad they continue to work together, and so frequently and beautifully. Every page of Pirate Stew, or Fortunately the Milk, or the Graveyard book, or Odd and the Frost Giant, or the recently re-illustrated Coraline book by Chris Riddell. It's frame-worthy. It is just so distinctive, the line work so distinguished and rare, and also at the same time so obviously Riddell. One is left contemplating what a thing it is to have such a recognisable style, such as he has, that will in the future be held up beside the likes of Briggs and Blake for his contributions to literature and society itself. Without Chris Riddell, there's no Zac Ferguson. Now, I know a lot of people will come out and go, oh, for fuck's sake, the whole reason this twat writes is because Chris Riddell inspired him and Paul Stewart. I'm sorry. Now, Paul Stewart and Chris Riddell have always been so good to me. So good to me. As a fanboy. And they treated me as a friend. On and off, if and when. And they have always been good to their fans. And always very encouraging to their readers. And this is a specificity I want to talk upon when it comes to Neil Gaiman and Chris Riddell and why they work so well. It is the encouragement to create and to express and to imagine. This book, of course, for a 25-year-old reader, writer and father myself, I can appreciate that it's a quick, fun, almost nostalgic read for the likes of myself, and at best something to cherish for what it stands out as, or could for our next generation of readers, knowing that young children will pick this book up and be inspired to pick up a pen themselves.
They will not be picking that book up.
Picking what book up?
That book up.
Pirate Stew? Yeah. Why?
You said they're not touching it.
Oh, yeah, of course they ain't, because it's signed by Neil Gaiman.
Well, then they're not really
quite literally.
Sorry.
The whole semblance and pairing of Neil Gaiman and Chris Riddell is to encourage and entertain and to delight and to motivate you to want to pick up a pencil to draw or write. For children, as in this book as a whole, as it is, it's snappy, sappy, zappy, something that needs to, of course, be read aloud for the reader to inhabit that vernacular and voice and go along for the ride. I couldn't imagine anything worse than a half-hearted reading of this. And while many will be buying this purely because of Riddell's art and Gaiman's name, I brought it as it was a great opportunity finally to own a signed book, as forementioned, and at a reasonable price. But whether it's signed or not, I would still have brought it. Granted, maybe not as quickly as I did for this one in particular, but I would still have brought it, or waited for Laura to buy it for me, of which is a great bone of contention, because I've been buying quite a lot of things, and she's like, just fucking stop, I need to be able to get you some Christmas presents. So, some will criticise the merits of children's books, especially for the ages of 2 to 5, as I would place this book as appealing to. About what does a writer really offer, when all it is in its whole is illustrations? Sometimes this may be the case, and one may argue that whatever it is that Gaiman adds prosaically isn't anything that impressive, just a guideline for Chris to work wonders. It being that of, Neil was just a name to see Riddell's art boasted and framed and pushed out and given attention to alongside his own. And I'm not saying at all Riddell isn't himself up there on people's tongues, but I'm trying to make my point here. This may also be true in some marketing fashion, but in all honesty, stop being pessimistic, Ferguson, and anyone else in a negative, moany form. Realise that they are a perfect combination and pair, because they both lend something to each other, whether credibility or reinforcing recognition. It isn't about that. It's about the will and want to create art. A writer sometimes is only as good as his audience allows him to be, right? Well, children can oftentimes be unforgiving as they mature, but when it comes to books and art specifically, and how it makes them feel, and one such as short and simple as a read as this is, as I've seen criticised in the past, and I am just left scratching my head at, it can mean so much more to a little person and shape a little one's future as a creative thinker or creator. This book is, for starters, a young person's book. It is a starter readers only book. It's not wanting to be an 800 page book like American Gods, so any criticism for prose and narrative, they need to get a life. Gaiman purely writes these short child books for his own children, and also I believe to keep the world of children's illustrations and art alive, especially in our current era. And if this means writing a simple children's book that benefits the likes of masters of the craft like Chris Riddell, I am behind it, me hearties. Buy it, read it, be taken away. And it is a superb reading experience. Get it for your little ones and give it a hoys and mateys and a yo-ho-ho. Get into the fun and the groove. I think that reading to your children is a dead art form in and of itself now. Just pushing them in front of iPads or televisions. Read a book to them. Read it over and over until the little ones will play out and live out the rest of these characters' adventures, of which we children do. Don't we? We read.
Do-do.
We do. We read stories, and then we imagine what these characters will do. We go on and reimagine, continue their stories. And I think that is helped by that encouragement by parents. It's okay to play. And that's what art does. It inspires and sparks creative minds that need sometimes a little magical push from the likes of a Chris Riddell or a Paul Stewart or a Neil Gaiman. So I gave Pirate Stew 4 stars. And I would recommend that you go out your way and buy it. And whilst you can, go get the signed copy from Waterstones. Now, I'm following up in the theme of the Paul Stewart and Chris Riddell thing. I want to review Wormwheeled Return as well. If you love powerful storytelling, fantasy, action, adventure and sensational world building quite unlike anything that has been written, and you adore and are as engrossed and taken away by the breathtaking artwork of Chris Riddell and the prose of Paul Stewart, well, buy this book. I know that Stewart and Riddell are known by many, and we will often turn to Paul and Chris's The Edge Chronicles, the most famous of books, and a long range of trilogies culminating into a 13-book series. When acknowledging their credits is their go-to, it is The Edge Chronicles. And sadly, the both of them have crafted many genre-busting and tackling realms together in multiple book series, and I feel they are not as often much known or reported for them, such as the far-flung adventures Fergus Crane, Corby Flood, Hugo Pepper, to Barnaby Grimes, to now Wormwheeled, a book of worms, varying bleak lands, built upon various mountain escape, full of kith, kin, dangers, love, romance, symbiotic bonding between a rare few riders and their steeds, the worms. These are dragons. The Edge Chronicles is a book series ever so close to my heart, and many, many million of others. Paul and Chris have always been artists I've dedicated my life to reading. But as one grows up, and the supposed tastes shift, and one discovers new writers, though those artists you adore and their works are still in your mind, your inclination is usually swayed by the potential of others of whom may perhaps start criticising you for still reading books aimed for teens or children. The usual retorts of, that's for kids. Brilliant storytelling is universal for all ages. This mentality bothers me, more so because I myself have been afflicted by this hollow sentiment and attitude. The greatest of books and stories told and shared over parchment or fires are ones usually composed and carried across for many a generation, dictated to children to leave their imprint. Something I feel has an advantage over some more literary lauded works that you are expected to have lodged in your noggin. If you love books that are mature in theme, content, and just by being a little bit more rugged and edgy, mind the pun there, than their usual works, this is something all Stewart and Riddell fans will clamour for. With a higher age grading for reading, Stewart excels in the emotion and descriptions and the desolate, harsh badlands, exalted by the meaner meteor, far denser layers offered by this story and its infrastructure, the environments and the characters inhabiting it, allowing a lot of freedom and content in this verse, and leaning hard on perhaps content and thematics that may they themselves feel are too risky for a younger readership of their books, with such like The Edge or much younger The Far-Flung Adventures. And this isn't to say the Edge books are not grotesque, bloody and full of mature and subtle nuances. I am not presumptuous to assume Stuart feels unleashed compared to the Edge and Grimes and Freelance books in particular, but I feel Hill and Chris are going with a different intent, different goal in its whole self, with it for being older readers, given far more allowances that might be criticised if used or conveyed in the Edge Chronicles of Barnaby Grimes novels. I feel this has freed up the creative duo in a lot of ways. Riddell's artwork is sparse, subtle, hinting mildly at the world, and it's extremely disappointing when you first head into this. I myself, much younger, was, yes, rather aggrieved to notice there's hardly any grand full page part, you know, page spreads that Riddell mania incorporated into the book's text and morphing into the binding of the text, into the text, out of the text, out of the frame of most of the Edge Chronicles books. Here the writing seems to be enough, not that previous books lack the lavish detail of description, but it's totally so different than their previous books. It is much meaner, grittier, also pulling from many sources of historically valued art and literature from centuries back. One even can recall a probably almost ode to the time of Beowulf, that world-renowned famous poem. As a reader, and especially a fan of a certain writer or illustrator, we do not steer towards their new releases like we used to when much younger, but are those of us who we acknowledge as being aimed for our age range, as the books we should be investing time and money into, whilst neglecting our inherent fanboy dedication to those of whom came before and introduced us to this world of reading. I know that Wormwood as a series was aimed at a higher age bracket, yet still didn't endeavour to read or buy those books myself back in 2010, aged 15. And as the years passed, and I got over myself, I got the three books in this series because what does it matter if it's marked as a book for 9 to 11, 12 to 16? A book is a book that one of any age can relate to and enjoy. So I finally started on this new quest on my own to thrust myself into those comfortable, nostalgic, powerful worlds offered to me by my old hombres, fall into the life-changing worlds and words and images that so motivated and inspired me to be not just a writer today, but a reader as well. So Wormwood is a fantastical world with an old western slant. It's felt, lived in, vast and epic in its desolation and crags, the mountains, the red waters. The world is so lived in and so beautifully conveyed by Stuart's and I also assume Riddell's contribution to the overall prose. A western, only with dragons instead of gunslingers. And so with the addition and love for dragons stroke worms, dear reader, as I mean, who doesn't love those? If you want to experience something, almost a whole other species of genre, a new form of genre, then look no further than this book series. The creative duo behind Fergus Crane, Barnaby Grimes, Blobheads, Muddle Earth and all the Edge Chronicles books put out nearly a decade ago. What I have noticed, and that Paul Stuart and Riddell have admitted to having, is that this series has not reached as many readers as the Edge books have, which for me I find is sad, very sad, as it's worth so much more love, affection and fandom. So take my advice, get in on this book series. As a reader grows up, he takes it upon himself to drift into so-called mature realms, adult books, whether general fiction or fantasy, and sometimes neglects to support and endeavour to continue the reading, the writers and creators that set them on this grandiose path of literature and discovery of world. One is almost ashamed to state that they love books written specifically for children or young adults, sometimes for good reason, yet this has never been the case of Paul and Chris's work for myself. They've always been on my mind and on my periphery. Only now, having matured even more, I know, finally, I've not even reached that yet, I can unapologetically go and buy these books in abundance and read them without this weird sense that is oddly bestowed onto us readers growing up by other readers or those other acquaintances or peers. And those around us as to it being immature, not a book one expects another to read, well, fuck right off. They wouldn't be saying that if they read such wonderfully fleshed out worlds and stories with some amazing characters and narrative threads that Paul Stuart and Chris Riddell put out. The books they create are not age-bound, but only bound by those willing to push that mind frame aside and to allow themselves to be taken away, whether by Skycraft or Worm. Read this first chapter in a trilogy, I have a feeling is going to stay with me and leave a mark quite akin to when I first discovered these two masterful artists' works back in 2004. So, that is my review segment over.
Thank the Lord, hey guys.
I mean, I'm cotton-mouthed, but I felt like I needed to get that out because I feel that Paul Stewart as a writer and Chris Riddell don't get much recognition.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
So, are we ending on... Now? We ending this podcast now?
I think we
You are. Look like you're settling back to read a book. So...
I was waiting for you to finish your review.
Sorry.
Do
you want to take us away? Is there anything else on your mind? Topicality-wise? I mean, I'm looking forward because I'm going on a very special date tomorrow.
You are? You're going on a very special date with your uncle.
My uncle Brian, of whom I bumped into locally. Now, Brian is a 50-year-old Down syndrome man, of whom is now living independently with off and on support. And I bumped into him just randomly and exulted to see him, and eventually when he recognised who I was, got his number, reached out to him today and said, do you want me to take you out for lunch tomorrow? And he seemed quite ecstatic about that.
Yes please, yeah. Yes please, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes please, yeah.
Yeah, Zach. His carer jumped in and she was like, I don't know no Sam. No Zach. I don't know who Zach is. Who is he? My nephew. So I'm looking forward to going to hang out with him. Get some lunch. And yeah.
I'm looking forward to a very interesting date in 2 weeks' time.
And that will be?
That will be a date with all the animals you could ever wish to drive through the enclosure.
Oh, yeah.
Longleat Safari Park, we are coming for you.
We are.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
And
ooh.
Southampton Travel Lodge, we're going to be bedding with you. And we're going to be ruining our diets once again because we're going to have breakfast inside of you.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
And we're going to go to a Green King for dinner the night before.
I mean, after those 2 days, we are going to have to starve ourselves or walk home.
I mean, it's quite simple. We have dinner at the Green King. You don't have to have a pudding and a starter.
No.
So you do your morning shake, you do your afternoon, you do your lunchtime shake, and then you have dinner, same as.
Yeah.
And then in the morning, you have your breakfast, and then you don't have anything till dinner. Same way we'd always have a cooked breakfast. Well, yeah, there we go then. I don't think it's going to be that much of a problem. Tonight, yeah, because we went all out, we splashed out. But other than that, it's not that too bad.
Chimpanzees! When you were going, ooh, 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 I was like, oh my God, the monkeys that we're potentially going to come in contact with have time travelled to warn us. Take off your windscreen wipers.
And my aerial. So, we've got some exciting times ahead.
I mean, it's
I think it would be really good to do a few, I think this would be more video-based, but a few...
Content for the Facebook page.
Yeah, a few video bits of Longleat and our travels there and stuff, and then we can throw it together like we normally do.
Yeah,
like we did before, so...
Like, instead of it being audio-based, we didn't really compute, we didn't really use our minds and go, actually, we could just do... Like, our travel
log. Well, this is the thing, is we can both record on the basis that we're going to put it up on Facebook Articular Warbling.
Yeah.
So we can, like... intermix it, and then you know how good I am at making little shorts our little like intros and stuff like that. So I think I'm super excited. Oh, I've got the whole week off.
We are also gonna try and go to
where are we going?
Crime Museum.
Oh yeah, we are, yeah. So Hastings have a crime museum apparently. And we are going to try and book tickets for that, which we should really get on to quickly.
Yeah, I think so.
Because that is in...
I might do that in a minute.
Just under 2 weeks.
But I think you can only buy them from there, or can you order online?
I think you can order online. We'll have a look.
Okay.
So, anyway, hopefully we'll be doing another podcast very soon. But if not, it will be our little travelogue to Longleat.
Well, yeah. Like, we're actually getting to go to the cinema Friday coming to see Ben Wheatley's Rebecca. Yeah.
And then probably have a couple of books by then as well. So
yeah,
we'll
hopefully.
Be able to do a bit of review on those kind of things too.
Yeah, I've started doing on the Facebook page written warbles, which if Laura wants to get behind it, she can join in as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I did a written warble about Redcon 1. I did actually record a first impression audio commentary, but there was just not enough in it that I felt.
I think we're going to have to start doing those first impressions from the very beginning. I think we're just going to have to go, right, is this a film? Do you think we could?
Yeah.
And then it's going to be one of those things. Because the thing is, the funniest things I ever say, like during Cloud Atlas, was like during the film, and we should have just had it on.
Yeah, I know.
So I think maybe we need to choose a couple of films that we don't necessarily do an audio commentary for, but we do a more kind of first impression
Gogglebox style type thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that would be a good option.
Yeah,
so,
we planned this last year, but I want to do it. I'm going to pick up one of the most cheesiest, corniest, cheapest Christmas books.
Oh yeah, we forgot about that.
From the works. I'm going to read it and hopefully review it. Also, I thought that we could do a couple of commentaries to one of the most successful, most well-renowned Christmas movies, like Home Alone and The Grinch. I think we would do some really funny commentaries for them.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll just be riffing about Macaulay Culkin.
I love Home Alone.
Walking as if he'd been literally raped on set by Michael Jackson. Anyway, sorry, Macaulay. I know you said nothing happened. I don't believe you. Christmas has come around the corner. And so is a new episode. Anyway, I'm going to have to crunch the numbers on these files and send them to DB. And hopefully he will be posting it within the next couple of hours or a couple of weeks. We don't know. It's very hit and miss with DB. Not criticising, I'm just saying. It's like,
we all have a busy life.
We have busy lives, and I really don't care whether he releases it in 2 weeks, 3 weeks. It's as long as it gets to you, and it always does. And when the man says he's going to do something, he actually does it.
Yeah, which is unlike most other people. So
that we've had to work with.
You've got to give him that credit.
What?
So,
it's a goodbye from me.
And it's a goodbye from me.
No, take your clothes off.
If you insist, Zach, and goodbye for me and everyone at Articulate Warbling, thank you. Remember to rate, review, subscribe wherever you do that. And thank you so much. Let your friends know, and okay, goodbye. And up next week, we will have Hubie Halloween First Impressions. I don't know how that's pronounced. I just keep looking at this file name for the next thing I'm going to edit, so hey. There we go. All right, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you soon. And if you want, you should check out my other podcast that I've got going on right now, The Ballad of Johnny Smoothskin. I can't tell you much more about it, but check out The Ballad of Johnny Smoothskin. Okay, bye.